I will open before I introduce. People will do a brief description. This is a pure white book. It's called Frog in the Kettle, and I bought the book for its cover to give to Bob Stivers, who's a religion prof who collects things on frogs. But the little story, I would prefer to have had Leo Tolstoy's thing on love and violence. It's an incredible book. It talks about a man who was so diseased, but at the end of his life, he didn't realize how sick he was because it was so gradual. Well, this is another picture of that. This is called Of Frogs. The signs we need to perceive are not vague predictions about the future. Many are present realities. The trouble is that they occur so gradually that we often do not notice them. It's like the familiar story of the frog in the kettle of water. Place a frog in boiling water, and it will jump out immediately because it can tell that it's in the hostile environment. But place a frog in a kettle of room temperature water, and it will stay there, content with those surroundings. Slowly, very slowly, increase the temperature of the water. This time, the frog doesn't leap out, but just stays there, unaware that the environment is changing. Continue to turn up the burner until the water is boiling. Our poor frog will be boiled, too, quite content, perhaps, but nevertheless, dead. Anyway, that can apply to any probably social issue. And since we're environmentally and ecologically concerned here, the frog is maybe a good metaphor for us today. But two of our gentlemen here, both a professor and a politician, are here to help us get started. And I say that because we label people and we assume they have the function of whatever they're named. And we'll find out a little bit more tonight. But Paul Menzel is a professor of philosophy at Pacific Lutheran University. And not only in ethics, but in the social responsibility that our thinking would take in that area. And he's been with us this week, and we're glad you're here, Paul. And then John Marty is a state senator from Minnesota, who, before I knew you were coming and we invited you, I heard you on public radio. And because you had some ideas, maybe that would kill your political future if you just stayed as a politician. But both are human beings who have concerns not only for the issues they're presenting tonight, but the larger issues of life. And so we're thankful for that. But today it is health care and access to it. And do you decide who's going first? Paul.
Professors always have statistics, so I'll start with a couple of those. And bear with me, Dave and Elizabeth Wold, you've seen these before at another presentation. Who are the uninsured? There are 35 million on any given day. In the age group, 19 to 24, 20.3% are uninsured all or part of the year. I didn't put all the age groups down here, but I thought that one was interesting. And also notice, since a lot of people think it's mostly younger people who are uninsured, notice that 13.6% of 55 to 64-year-olds are uninsured all or part of the year. This is not a problem of young people who don't yet have a full-time job, or young people who think they're so healthy that they don't need insurance. It's transparently not just a problem for them of that at all. Of those 35 million uninsured on any given day, 47% of people below the poverty line are uninsured on any given day. And between the poverty line and 200% of poverty, 40% are uninsured on any given day. It is often said that the poor are not uninsured in our society because they're covered by Medicaid. It's just the near poor that are. That's not true either. Both the near poor and the poor have very high percentages of uninsured. Medicaid dollars, if we just look at the dollars, 70% of Medicaid dollars go to blind, disabled, and elderly people, not necessarily to those people who are eligible for Medicaid on the basis of their poverty. 50% of Medicaid dollars goes to long-term care for the elderly. Politicians and others have noted that there's a problem with the way Medicaid has evolved. It was originally set up to just provide insurance for the poor, provide access for the poor, but more than half of its funds are now going to the population who was originally thought to be the province of Medicare, not Medicaid. But since Medicare has never gotten around to covering long-term care, since people then who are otherwise covered by Medicare spend themselves down into medical indigency in old age, they become eligible for Medicaid, but that's not what the whole program was intended for to begin with. And yet it's using up, that part is using up half of Medicaid dollars. Medicaid covers only 53% of the population below the poverty line. That's because it's usually by eligibility for welfare, not by poverty per se, that one gets Medicaid. Any questions about those statistics? Those are just a few. I could have picked out many things about before, but I thought those were interesting.
Can you give a sense of what the poverty line is? That's not what it's necessarily
known. It's 12, what is it, 13,000 now for a family of four? 7,000 for a single person, 9,000 for a, 10,000 for a family with two. The 200% is rough, is 24,000 for a family of four, 25,000 for a family of four. I don't know what we'd call that in other image terms. I guess I call it the upper low class, not quite the low middle class. I mean, a family of four with 25,000, 24,000 income is very low middle class.
They sometimes call the working poor.
Or the working poor. Right. Or the near working near poor, or number of children uninsured. I don't have that figure. That's alarmingly high too. Not as high. It's alarming because you know you think of children, but it's not as high as some of these other figures. It's not anything like 47%, because the most because AFDC people are the that's the largest. Most automatic Medicaid eligible category. So a single parent with children is more likely to have the children covered than other poor children would be, but that's a significant number of the poor children. Okay, one of the things, if we look at the structure of healthcare in the, some of you saw this on Monday, I put it up here for one reason, which I'll get to in a minute. Who gets government assistance for healthcare? Well, there's a lot of government assistance for healthcare. Medicare, obviously, and that isn't just for the poor. We pay for healthcare, over 50% of it is paid by private insurance, 25% by public insurance, and a little less than 25% out of pocket. Financing is through Medicare, Medicaid, through employer-paid premiums, subsidized 40% through a regressive tax break, and I'll get to a particular point in relation to the poor about that in a minute, and obviously through patient-paid premiums and patient out-of-pocket expenses, cost-sharing, eliminate the other things that are up for other purposes, not this topic. Now, the tax subsidy or the tax break for employer-paid premiums in particular is a regressive tax. It works this way, and I'll explain both how that it's regressive and that it is, and what its total amounts to relative to Medicaid. If you pay a dollar for health insurance premiums through your employer, all of that goes toward your insurance and none of it is taxed, not a single penny. Tax excludable. No state and local income tax, no social security tax of yours, no social security tax of the employers, and no income, federal income tax. If you take that dollar home for other things, somewhere between 15 and I should have said 33 cents is paid in income tax, depending on your bracket, 8 for your part of social security tax, 8 cents for the employer's social security tax, part of the social security tax, and some other perhaps for state and local income taxes if there are any.
you're already, even if you were in the 15% bracket, the lowest bracket, you're already at 31 cents. You're in the 33-cent bracket, you're actually at 52 cents. So it's somewhere between 30 and 50% of employer-paid premiums. That is for people with stable jobs and employers big enough to be buying health insurance premiums. That's generally not poor people or even the near poor. It's generally the middle class and up. They get 30 to 50% tax break. Now, what does that amount to? It is more than the total money that we spend on Medicaid. Just remember that. The government is subsidizing people in general, even discounting Medicare. Leave Medicare out of it. The government is subsidizing the health care of citizens in our society more in total dollars than who aren't poor than it is in the Medicaid programs for the poor. So one comment you hear is, oh, the government can't get more involved in this, it doesn't have the money. There's a big chunk right there. Of course, every politician that mentions getting rid of the employer-paid tax break for health insurance premiums gets cut off at the ankles. Mark Hatfield, Senator Packwood mentioned it about 5 years ago and retracted, publicly apologized for making the statement before about a week later. He got so much flack for it. And even a apparently progressive state like Oregon. It's one of those things that we have gotten very, very used to. It came in very appropriately at a time in the late 40s when there needed to be some encouragement for employers to provide insurance, given to nobody else's. The government as a whole wasn't going to get in the act. But one could argue it is simply out of place now. Note that some countries, the issue is not total cost. It seems to me the issue is not total cost either. Look at a couple of countries. I use this on Monday, but I'll use it in a different context now. This is just a reproduction of a newspaper article, so it's a bad reproduction. But take Canada, for example, since there's a lot of talk about could the Americans use the Canadian system now? There are a lot of differences, and I don't want to oversimplify it, to be sure. But notice that Canada has basically kept total health care costs constant as a percentage of its gross national product in the last 10 years, the United States has continued to go up fairly sharply. It automatically causes us to ask the question, if we had the Canadian system, would we have the money to ensure access for everybody? The Canadian system does give access to everybody, but if we did it and had not only the access that they provide for everybody, but the other features that save them money, would we, in effect, perhaps be able to do this without any extra increase in total health care costs at all? I'll get to that later when we consider some options, but it causes us, at least international comparison certainly causes us to ask some questions. It seems to me that at least a plausible list of the essential conditions for health care system reform is this one. This isn't mine, this is Larry Brown's from Columbia. But he just listed the following, a speech I heard 6 months ago or so, and I was very impressed with this as an analysis of what was going to be essential. He said there would have to be a call to arms. I think there is already. That condition has been met. The crisis, however, he thought must be felt by the middle class and by a sufficient number of politically influential groups, the AARP, for example, businesses, etc., so that they would not block reform. Crucial politically influential groups. Enough of the politically influential groups have to stop blocking reforms. Wide agreement on a general direction of reform. This, I think, is completely missing in the current context. We don't have agreement on the general direction of reform. There may be in a particular state legislature, but Washington State there isn't. There may be in Minnesota. Majority agreement on an actual plan. And I think finally, for it to pass and stick, there has to be the perception by the middle class and many politically influential groups that they would be better off with the new plan than the current system. That's tough in the American context with the current 30-50% subsidy of private health insurance premiums paid by employers. It's going to be real tough in another system that the middle class will see as costing them no more than the current system. Real tough. We may have boxed ourselves in a hard political corner. I'm sorry to be pessimistic before we start.
You're doing?
I'll talk a little bit about the politics of it and also about what Minnesota's done, and you were going to make a few more comments about the options, other types of proposed systems, and then we'll open it up. This past year I was working on a thing at the University of Minnesota, which I was looking at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that the U.S. is one of the charter members of the U.N. signed, and virtually every major country signed a statement on Universal Declaration of Human Rights in which one of the 40 or so points on the Universal Declaration is that every citizen of the world deserves adequate access to food, shelter, health care, and other such things. And here, that came up this year right after we had our health care plan vetoed this year in Minnesota. And I keep thinking, we've given up on trying to take care of third world and other places like that in terms of health care. We can't even in Minnesota get a plan through to take care of uninsured people. It struck me as how far away we are from agreement on what we agreed was a human right to, of every citizen when we as a country signed that 40 some years ago. It strikes me that we're going backwards, we're giving up hope, we're saying we can't try some of these things, and I think we're the worst for it. Minnesota has tried more than a lot of states. I wouldn't say what we've done has been earth-shattering, and I don't expect anything earth-shattering in the next few years. But several years ago, we did a first, and that was to ensure every child up to age 6 and now up to age 8 a health care plan. If you're low income, you can get preventive care, all kinds of care, $25 a year per child. And basically, the program is slowly but surely becoming available to people simply because they're finding out about it. One of the things you find out is even when something's available to somebody, not everybody knows about it. I talked to this year when we were having our vote on our health care plan, talked to one of the people in the Capitol cafeteria. They're food service workers who, I don't know what kind of income they're making, but this one woman was a grandmother, and she had her little grandkid there one day, and was talking about how important it was because her grandkids didn't have health care access. And we talked about her daughter was unaware of the possibility for the program. But those kind of things are taking effect, and in Minnesota, we should be saying everybody under age 8. Basically, I think most of them have access to health care that way if they know about it. There's a proposal to extend it totally to age 18, and the only reason it failed was because of lack of dollars. And I was figuring, well, if we can't get our health care access the way we tried this year, maybe what we'll do is increase it to age 18 and maybe age 28 some year and maybe 38 in a couple of years we might get the health care plan we need. But several years ago, several legislators decided they thought it was time for Minnesota to do it. I think most people in most state legislators that feel that health care access should be a right of every citizen feel it would be better if the federal government did it, just for some uniformity and all kinds of other things that don't work that well when one state does it at a time. But there's the general feeling that the federal government is not going to do it. Not in much longer term, they're not going to be doing it. So I think Minnesota, among other states, is looking at trying to do it. I think the advocates of such proposals want to make sure it's done right, partly because you only get one chance. If we try it and it falls through, we're not going to have another chance, and we can forget this kind of thing. 3 years ago, there was a push to get it. What passed, not surprisingly, was a study. When in doubt, if there's not whatever else, you decide, well, let's study the issue further. This time, fortunately, the study came with a commission and a staff to do some research on the whole issues. 2 years to do the study, came back in January this year with a report on healthcare access and what they proposed. And they proposed simply roughly 400,000 some Minnesotans are without healthcare some part of the year. Ballpark figure that's widely disputed between various groups how many people are actually without healthcare. But they came back with a plan that would provide a comprehensive healthcare plan on a sliding fee scale. So if your income, it was about 250% of poverty or lower, you were eligible for the sliding fee program. Maybe it was three times poverty level, but you were eligible for state-provided healthcare access, healthcare insurance program, and you'd have to pay premiums based on your income, and the higher your income, the more you'd have to pay. Along with that was a proposal that every Minnesotan had to be covered by health insurance. So it was going to be truly universal coverage, and an attempt to make it affordable to everyone so it's not just idle words. Because of the cost would have been somewhere not too far under $300 million per year, $600 million in our two-year budget cycle that's out of a state budget right now that's roughly $15 billion in that two-year period. So it's a significant increase in the state budget and significant implications for that, because there wasn't the political votes to do it. In our state Senate, something like two-thirds of the members of the Senate signed on as co-authors of this bill, myself among them. Two-thirds is easily enough to get the bill passed. You only need half. And matter of fact, that's enough to override a veto. But then when it came down to it, they like the idea, but we can't afford it right now. And the plan slowly got scaled back to the plan that finally passed was one that would be a slowly phased-in program, was only going to cover outpatient and preventive care types of services. Prevention is a big buzzword these days, and I think rightly so. So all kinds of checkups and that sort of thing would have been available to people with and they were very good about keeping out high patient co-payments. I think for most types of things, there's no co-payment required. And it would have phased in more and more people per year, and by 1997, there would be a requirement that all Minnesotans would have health care coverage. And the plan did pass the legislature the last week of the session by fairly narrow margins. Enough of a margin that it wasn't one or two people making a difference, but not enough to override a veto. And the governor, who, like a whole lot of my colleagues, which I didn't realize this at the time, but this afterwards and during some of the debate this year, I was hearing from some of the advocates from the commission how many legislators had made campaign promises they supported universal health care coverage in Minnesota. Despite that, and despite the massive number of co-authors of the bill, it was a hard fight to get it in there that way. And the governor, among those who had talked about making health care affordable, he claimed he was undecided the day he had to decide whether he was vetoing it or not. He met with the two authors of the bill and told them he was still open to it, and they left the meeting. One of them's in the office right next to mine, and she left the meeting thinking he was very open and likely to sign it, and then they found out later he had made a pre-agreement with the business community he wasn't going to sign it, and vetoed the bill. There's going to be an attempt to override the veto next session. I think the Senate may have the votes. I doubt it's going to be overridden in the long run. I think we're on the right track with it. It's not what I would call the ideal healthcare system. 4 years ago, we came to Holden Village. Our daughter dislocated her elbow. We had to take her out of the village for a 10-second procedure just to pop it back in place. But the nurse said you need an x-ray before you do it, so you make sure there's no nerve damage. And not counting the ferry ride and everything else, we went to the Chelan Hospital and quick x-ray. The doctor and the clinic, the doctor and the x-ray bills totaled about $200. And in the process of it, of getting it, getting compensation. Our system works that we provide the bills to our insurer and they pay 80% and then we get the co-payment. Each one of them sent a separate bill. Each one of them sent two or three bills before our insurer paid its share, and then we did it. We were two of the three bills went to a collection agency before it finally came through. I think we've got a pretty good health insurance cover. If you figure out any of the studies of how much people spend on, how much it costs one business letter to go out in secretarial time or whatever else, there were at least 30 pieces of correspondence over a 5-minute operation. How much of that 200 some bucks of health care was going into paperwork. This plan wouldn't simplify. It's not a single payer plan, which you'll talk more about, but nevertheless, I think people deserve healthcare access, and there are stories. I mean, the groups who are advocates for the programs can come back with numerous examples. A woman in southern Minnesota, Albert Lee, a couple of years ago, lost her insurance when she or her husband was laid off, and was sick with some weird kind of thing. She had gone to the clinic, and the local clinic, and they said, well, come back if it's more serious, and she ended up in Mayo Clinic in Rochester and died, and basically it was a preventable type of illness. We've heard stories of kids who don't have ear infections treated because their parents are debating if they can afford to. And later on, they have hearing loss because of untreated infection. I think in Minnesota, in the United States, that's inexcusable. I'd like to see us move that way, and I'm confident that within a year or two, Minnesota will have some sort of plan. I think what surprised me most was a whole lot of my colleagues, especially from greater Minnesota, the rural parts of the state, who said it was a really hot issue. I was doing, because I cared about it, I wasn't hearing a lot from my constituents doing it. I have a wealthier group of constituents than the state average. But there are a whole lot of people who are one layoff notice away from losing their health insurance. They're very close to losing their insurance for one reason or another. And that goes to bankruptcy then. And I guess I didn't realize how strong the political will seems to be in Minnesota, at least, but I'm hearing from colleagues who, we've got to have this plan. We promised it and they need it. And so I'm pretty optimistic it's going to pass one way or another, despite the governor's objections.
Just quickly look at a couple of other major plans. They're a little more ambitious, perhaps, than the one that Minnesota has done, but I think this will show what a dilemma we're facing politically in terms of what direction to go in. This would be the Canadian system. I don't know how much you know about the Canadian system, but there's a state senator in Washington who's strongly plugging a Canadian analog plan, we could call it. The population covered is everyone by the plan. That is, it would displace private insurance. The great political liability of this plan is precisely that it puts the insurance, private insurers out of business. The great efficiency benefit of that is that you've got a single payer.
And you don't have all those routine bill fights.
Right, precisely the point you made about that. And the estimates are that that's somewhere between, I think the most conservative estimate these days is that's 8%. That inefficiency is 7 or 8%, and the rest of it's run all the way up to about 14% of the total health care expenses. If 15% of our population is uninsured, you could make up about half the expense of expanding the coverage would come from greater efficiency in billing if you had a single payer and no insurance company, other insurance company. Now, doctors don't mind the Canadian system because doctors get paid fee for service. Hospitals get just a block budget. You might have the hospital association screaming bloody murder about this kind of plan. But since a lot of them are running into debt already anyhow, they might think they're going to be better off under this than they are in the current situation. Physicians aren't necessarily opposed to it, though physicians are afraid that with just a single payer, you've got monopsony or monopoly buyer, so to speak. And then the physicians are going to be, at least specialists' incomes are going to get talked way down. And undoubtedly that would happen. It has happened somewhat in Canada. But there's one thing that is interesting about the Canadian system. Though it's a single payer system and everybody's locked into the same system, in a sense, not everybody is. You aren't locked into that system. because you can buy, there's a buyout allowed, namely, you can purchase care that isn't covered. You can even insure for care that isn't covered by the Canadian government. Do ban extra billing. That is, they don't allow physicians to charge you extra, claiming that I'm a special, a better physician whose costs are higher or command more in the market, and therefore you should pay more for me than the government's willing to pay other physicians. They ban extra billing. But for a procedure that's not covered, you can buy extra insurance. You can buy private insurance. There's just no market for it. It's interesting that there isn't any market for it heretofore. That's one option. It's terrible political liability is that people will, it'll get branded as socialistic because it's a single payer. It's not, in a sense, it's not totally because you can buy out. You can buy extra care that the government doesn't cover if there's a market for it, market enough for it that there's some provider there to get it to. Its other political liability is that the insurance companies will fight it to death.
I'd like to add one to that, and you sort of said it, but make it clear how powerful the arguments on that are. And that is, in effect, in Minnesota's plan, what we'd be, with our plan, was going to be like $600 million in a two-year period. With a plan like this, it would be several billion dollars. Because basically everybody has to stop paying their own health insurance now. In effect, the taxes go up to cover it, so your health care costs go way down. If you're paying several hundred bucks a month in health care coverage, in effect you're paying it in taxes and then getting the government providing
it. Look what
so the bill looks many times bigger.
It isn't necessarily bigger, because if you look at what employers are paying for your insurance, and they wouldn't no longer be paying, to be sure they and citizens would be paying taxes. And if there's a 10% efficiency gain just in having a single bill, single payer, and if in the long run physician fees, it's for specialists, can be talked down,
it might be cheaper, but it sounds like it's a big expense.
It's not easy to sell as anything other than expensive. Well, healthcare reforms that do ensure really good universal access are not just social, quote, socialistic or single payer. The Canadian one is single payer and is open to that charge. But here's one from a very conservative outfit, the Heritage Foundation, called Subsidized Market Choice. This was in the AMA's JAMA's special issue, was one of the major plans featured. Eliminate the regressive employment-based tax break. That's its terrible political liability. How are you going to get the support of the middle class for this if it contains that? But other than that, I mean, well, even including that, it makes a lot of sense. Substitute universal and sharply graduated tax credit for that employment-based tax break for the purchase of all approved minimum standard plans. It would be graduated. A person with a family of $40,000 income would get no tax credit. A family of $20,000 would get quite a bit. And a standard of family of 10 would have the whole plan paid for by the tax credit. It's a graduated voucher kind of system. All citizens use the purchasing power then in the market. Insurers would be around, but the Heritage Foundation claims that with the elimination of the tax break, competition would be so fierce that you would have a vast increase in managed care. Why? Because managed care plans are single payer plans of a sort. They don't have all these complicated billings, and therefore they'd save 10%. And if we removed the tax break, got sufficient competition, they'd win. They'd capture like 50-60% of the market over a period of time. The more likely, people with pre-existing conditions would be, you'd require that they not, that no insurer could deny them coverage. You can cover and handle that sort of thing in this sort of system. And then there's the common one. As I mentioned, there are political liabilities of this, though it, I think, makes a lot of sense otherwise. This one, there are perhaps few political liabilities to, except maybe some opposition from business. But I would argue that it doesn't make much sense. This is the one that the version of this is the American Medical Association's proposed plan, and another version of this sort of thing is what the Pepper Commission came out supporting. That you expand the health insurance paid
for by employers. Require employers to pay more for, in health insurance for their employees, namely part-time employees. How is this done? Any employer over 25 employees must provide maximum minimum benefit insurance. You still have a minimum standard of what constituted acceptable insurance coverage. Then you'd also have a public sponsor plan for part-time workers, very small businesses, and self-employed. And businesses would have to contribute a percentage of every part-time worker's pay into that pool. Self-employed people would also have to. It would be graduated. Then after that, the premium would be graduated. And this would be the same plan, though, for part-time workers and self-employed people. Self-employed people can go out and buy other insurance, too, but at least they'd be guaranteed that this would be accessible to them. This would be the same plan that would also apply for apply to Medicaid. We just wouldn't have Medicaid anymore. We'd have this bigger public sponsor plan. Cost control, I would argue, is very little in this kind of system, unless the current tax break is sharply limited, but it won't be. The political niceness of this is you don't have to get rid of the tax break, but that's precisely its Achilles heel. Without either eliminating the tax break or a single-payer system, I don't see that it's going to contain costs. And then down the road, business is going to be screaming bloody murder if they're being driven to bankruptcy because we haven't gotten a hold on healthcare costs. So though this is the plan that a number of its proponents say is the only plan that's really feasible politically now, I'm not sure it's politically feasible in the long run. I think it might be that plan which would do us in and create such a backlash against an extensive attempt at reform that we'd be in bigger trouble than we were before, but that's only my opinion.
Yeah, so thank you, John and Paul, and now it's open to you folks who all have access, I assume, right? Anybody here without access to health care?
Self-employed. Low income. So, and you didn't mention that category. Well, every year it changes. Sometimes you get a tax break, sometimes you don't. I mean, in the last 20 years that we've been self-employed, it's just changed so many times, you never know from when you're going to get what you're going to get. And mainly what we self-employed people carry is just major medical. So every time you have a medical cost, you pay for that out of your pocket. So the only time you get any benefit from it, the premium you pay is if you have...
Yeah, you just don't get the same tax break that
somebody
working for a large employer gets.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, you get something like 10 or 15%, and they get 30 to 50%. I mean, talk about something that's anti-free enterprise.
And it's much more expensive for us because we don't have a group plan to buy into either.
No, I don't know specifically. My guess would be that it's becoming increasingly popular for employers to pay not 100%, but more like 90% of the cheapest plan. And they'll give employees an option of two to three plans.
Yeah, I don't think they're paying much more than 40% of what the premium would be if you're a family. In other words, they'll pay for the employer.
Oh, family. Yeah, I'm talking about the employer.
Yeah, if they pay for the employer, they might pay for the employer, but they typically don't pay for the family. And then, you know, you have all the other deductions and stuff. So the employee winds up paying the rest of it out of his own pocket.
But still gets the tax break because what employers are now doing is... If my employer would have to pay, would contribute 90%, let's suppose that's $90, it would be more than that, but suppose it's $90 on my insurance. That's completely tax excludable income. Then, if the insurer that I sign up with for that $100 plan, I'm paying $10, my employer $90, is willing to insure my spouse and two children for another $200. So the total cost of the package is $300. What my employer does is pay all 300 and then deduct 210 of it, all but the 90 my employer is paying for me, from my monthly paycheck. And all 300 is considered tax excludable. So all you have to do is be covered. If your employer isn't doing that, your employer is just not using this loophole in the tax law.
I don't think most employers are set up to capture your plan like that or a section of it. I don't think a lot of employers have set up that particular code section. Either. They just dump the employee's lap and say, here, it's $250 bucks a month, whatever it is.
Write it, so the employee writes a check every month for the extra insurance?
No, you
know. They can't picture that being.
Not only they'll pay the entire premium deducted from the employee's pay, but it usually comes out of the net pay, it doesn't come out of their gross pay. The plan you're talking about is allowable, but I don't think a lot of employers have set it up. You know, it's set up, it comes out of gross pay.
Can't picture that.
Part of the problem is they have.
The employers I know who have done it have done it the other way. Just because it's so much money to the employee, most employees, I'd picture it to scream if they didn't have that. Not that everyone would know it, but usually somebody in a business knows about it.
It's also money to the employer because they don't have to pay Social Security tax for the employee on that extra $210.
Assuming they have a certain type of plan, but if they set it up in their cafeteria plan, then that's true. But typically, the employers have just simply deducted it from the net pay. So the employee has paid gross pay less all these taxes and then taken another $200 out of their pocket and paid the employer back, essentially.
That's not a smart employer, given the current
tax. Well, but I think that's typically the way the small employers do it. I don't think most 50 or 100 employee, you know, the smaller businesses,
they don't realize what
those plans. Yep. And they, yep. you know, they yep. go out and negotiate. They're on a community yep. rated basis, yep. so they don't have an individual plan. The insurance carrier comes in and says, here's your premium. Yep. You know, it's not even negotiable. Yep. And so the employer doesn't set up a front end, you know, voluntary for whatever it is section of that.
Another discouragement in our system for small employers.
I think we can get a sense of that now. People want to admit whether they have a cafeteria type plan in terms of the benefits that they have through their employer. If they don't have that, I think they're in a position where they probably aren't receiving full deductibility. But I know we were in a position where my wife changed employers and she happened to go from one law firm to another. And the new firm does have a cafeteria plan, and the other one, they were both large firms.
The employer can deduct the portion for your family, even if the employer isn't paying.
I think it's still unusual, however, to have the cafeteria plan.
Cafeteria plan is not required for this tax excludability. The cafeteria plan is not required for the tax excludability.
You know, what I think happens is that the employer, like my firm's 230 attorneys, okay? And they pay only for the employee, and the reason for that is because when they start, because then the premium is the same for everybody. If they start paying for some people who have children and spouses or some, then they're paying differing amounts of money. Wouldn't that be?
That's PLU pays only 90% of my plan, but if I pay the extra $210 to cover my spouse and my two children. Myself, 10 for myself,
right.
Then 200 for them. PLU takes $210, not 300 because it's paying 90, $210 off my income, but it does it before the income gets taxed and before PLU pays Social Security on it or before I do. And that is
allowable if
PLU offers only one plan to all employees.
And I hadn't thought about this, but you're right. It's in the employer's interest to do it as well because it saves them the Social Security tax.
Well, the thing that boggles my mind is what you were saying, Mr. Marty, is the paperwork you get on things. I knew my husband was in the hospital. We had to have some tips. And my gosh, they kept sending paperwork. It wasn't right, and this wasn't right. And they sent it back, and all the postage and all the paper that they, you know, use. And what is the percentage? It came out a while back. How much
money? You were saying 8 to 14%.
Estimates are running anywhere from 8 to 14%.
I thought it was higher than that.
So it's 24% is one estimate for administrative costs in the American system,
that.
But only, even on that highest study estimate,
it's
only
ridiculous.
14 of the 24 is from billing
and
inefficiency.
Yeah, it's. I mean, 14%. If it is 40, well, even if it's 8% of a couple thousand buck a year health care bill, 8% is a lot of money. And again, my own carrier is. I don't know if they were. It took them a little longer to pay it than I think it should have. But in Minnesota, when we're at home, we've had two children under the plan. We never saw a single bill. We pay our co-payment through the plan and through the employer, and so we get the tax deduction for the whole thing. And we never saw a single bill for anything. The only thing we pay for is $5 a prescription, and it saves all the paperwork. They all have it internally. It's a managed care system, an HMO. But I assure your frustration, because I've seen so many people, seen so many seniors who have to deal with a whole lot of my grandmother and great-grandmother-in-law. Elderly woman lives alone and has a lot of medical bills. She gets these things, and confusing as can be. I can't figure them out, and how she can is a good question. And it's a terrible waste of paper.
I have a point on medical bills for the elderly, which is that I had a situation at work where a gentleman was seeing his local country doctor who took Medicare assignment. In other words, my understanding was whatever Medicare paid was what that gentleman would have to pay, so he didn't pay anything extra. And his health deteriorated, and they sent him to Seattle to a large hospital. And the large hospital had him be seen by 9 different clinical specialists. And he had a $260,000 medical bill when he died 6 weeks later. And what had happened is that nobody had ever talked to any of these doctors about whether or not they take Medicare assignment. And the family, I mean, the local doctor assigned off the hospital, and the hospital assigned to the, you know, different clinics. And the question then came up, whether he had to pay the $260,000, because nobody had addressed the issue for him, and as far as, you know, he was getting Medicare assignment. And of course, he was then passed on, but everyone admitted nobody had ever had a conversation about that. And it was really the first time it came to my attention about the distinction, and we went to each of the doctors individually and said, you know, we thought he was on assignment, you know, nobody ever discussed this with us, and to their credit, each of them, you know, took the Medicare assignment. And so, and the hospital itself took a hit for $60,000. But I would encourage people in that similar situation, you know, if you think you're on assignment and you get referred out to specialists who just kind of, they just all kind of came, you know, and the family didn't even really feel like they had any control over what was going on. It's just like, you need to see this person and this person and this person. And it certainly became important to me to have an understanding with the various doctors about what their, a lot of them never saw anything in the family, of course.
That's an interesting point, and I hadn't, I'm interested to hear that, because I was talking with some people about a proposal I was interested in to require mandatory assignment for specialists. There was a proposal in Minnesota several years ago to require it for everyone. But general practitioners tend to be undercompensated through Medicare and specialist Medicaid, and specialists tend to be overcompensated. The cost, just because of the way they figure their rates for the procedures. And I didn't realize a lot more specialists were not taking assignment. But you might be right about that. And if so, it's a double unfairness. The family practice kind of person is undercompensated in the first place, and then they're accepting that as their full payment, and those who are specialists don't. But I had a proposal I haven't done anything with because I hadn't known enough about the issue. But I guess I'm real interested to know more about that one.
And I talked to a doctor once, you know, the next Rotary meeting or something. He goes, that could happen. So maybe they need to sign up for what this plan is, you know, before they get cured or something, so it's clear.
I just had a question about the Canadian system. If Rick Shkay needs a little bit of surgery, can he pay out of his own pockets? Even though that little bit of surgery is covered under the Canadian plan, a doctor can do it independently.
Yes, for if you don't want to wait in line, for example,
right,
you can pay.
Okay, so that add-on.
However, there are some practical barriers to that. There are a lot of physicians in the Canadian system who won't let people jump queue just by paying privately, because of a conviction that they shouldn't be allowed to.
And some come to the U.S. for that purpose, to avoid the line.
You said on that overhead, there was some term like add-on, that add-ons are not allowed or something.
Add-ons are allowed. Extra billing is banned. That is, assignment is mandatory.
So her problem,
our term for it is assignment. Right. They use the reverse term is extra billing.
Okay,
and
so
in Canada, extra billing is banned. That is, if I do a heart surgery on you, I can't charge you more than the government rate.
even if I pay it all?
Unless you pay it all.
Unless you pay.
Okay, all right.
If you pay it all, I can.
Right.
You can in turn even get insurance for paying it all outside right. the government rate. The government doesn't, Canadian government doesn't prohibit
right.
people selling, insurers selling or subscribers buying such insurance. There just is no market for it so far in Canada. There is a market for that insurance, by the way, in Britain, to the tune of 10% of the total medical dollars in Britain. So people are much less dissatisfied with the level of health care provided by the British National Health Service in Britain than Canadians are heretofore satisfied with the level of health care provided by the Canadians.
Yes.
When you talk about Canadians, just a guess on your part, what do you think the possibility is for adopting a similar type of agreement with the Canadian system? Do you have much of a chance?
If I think in terms of ideas and what might capture the imagination of people, I would say it's very likely. There's a good prospect. If I think in terms of other more perhaps cynical reasons, factors that may be necessary for political change, I get extremely pessimistic because you would be doing away with the tax break, current tax break for employer-paid premiums, and substituting for that, as well as for the total expense, a tax. So people with middle-income people would be taxed, presumably, at just about a pro rate of basis, assuming wealthier people are taxed more than the average and poorer people are taxed less for the average expense, say $2,400 per person for health insurance, which means middle-income people would be taxed, well, say $5,000 for the care that goes to their family of four. But currently, they're not paying anything. A middle-income family isn't paying anything like $5,000 for insurance because the, let us say, $6,000 they're paying for the total package of insurance for their family gets a 40% subsidy by the government, and they're really only paying $3,500. Now, some politician's going to call that to people's attention.
If you're using the current tax brackets.
And is going to try to milk the middle class for opposition to any proposed Canadian animal.
The one thing I will modify his comments on, I think he's right, it's the kind of plan that could capture people's imagination when they see the percentage of GNP spent on health care and the fact of how many are not covered now. I think he's right, it could do that, and he's right, there are big political liabilities that make it only if it catches on that way. In response to the second thing, though, about who is going to be paying the additional burden from it, it depends what kind of tax brackets we use. If you're going to use the existing tax brackets and just add on, increase the percentage of income tax, the brackets we have now, and increase them all a certain amount to do that, then that argument can be made. You can also tilt it so the high end is paying more and middle class is paying less. And along with all the proposals on whether Social Security is a fair tax, because it's a very regressive tax, and some of these payroll taxes are, there is some sentiment for changing it and also getting rid of that argument at the same time by shifting who's paying what percentage of it.
It's almost 10. I think we'll take the last gentleman's. Is the room being used by anyone after this? I don't believe so. You're more than welcome to stay after 10, but for those who need health care and sleep and things like that, so you don't need a doctor tomorrow.
Whoops.
Use your problem. But last question for tonight.
Well, my question has to do with the elements involved in all this. I virtually ignorant of all of it, but in exploring the medical insurance companies, is that a good business to be in right now? And are they making lots of money? Does anybody know that?
Insurers are staying alive quite nicely. I think whether you'd invest in them in the long run future would be a political judgment.
Would they be involved in trying to block any change?
Vociferously involved.
especially the single payer ones, but I mean, there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the current Minnesota proposal too. And it depends on the type of insurer and what they're doing, how they feel about it. They all oppose the single payer type of plan because it basically puts them out of business. And well, you'd need a lot of people to do the same sort of thing, so it wouldn't mean the necessarily direct loss of jobs. Nevertheless, there is a agony of switching from one employer to another, and there would be a lot of problem with that.
Are they a powerful entity, I guess?
Health insurance lobbies are very, very powerful lobbies at state capitals and in Washington.
If a whole bunch of other groups start lobbying on the other side, how powerful would they remain? Are they just an essential component in a political agreement here?
With most of these types of things, a powerful lobby, a particular type of business, has major impact for a number of reasons, some of them financial and some of which just how many people they have presenting their point of view hour after hour after hour. One of the reasons I think that Minnesota's plan passed this year was our senior federation, which is a state group comparable to AARP, and a lot of the senior groups got very involved in it, and they felt strongly about it, and they were pro the plan, in favor of the plan. And I think the clout from that, from hearing seniors are a very vocal and active political force, and I would say that that plus farm areas, certain rural communities, people feeling very strongly about it, they can overcome very powerful opposition from health insurers and so on. The trouble is, if they're not active and not united on it, then the only people there showing up to talk about it are the health insurers, and they do not support most types of these things.
Okay, folks, just 10. I want to thank John and Paul for their contribution tonight, and continue the, I hope, dialogue, because this issue is anything but over. Thank you.